despite the inherent horror he was describing, David was almost smiling as he retold this story, clearly in his element and filled with pride at what he'd been capable of all those years ago. The Naga huts were blazing, the guns were firing, the smaller arms were popping away, my mortar was thudding away in the background. That night a thunderstorm broke out, and about 2:30 in the morning there was a flash of lightning, a roar of thunder, and out of the ground came 2 companies of Japanese shrieking their heads off. It was the most unearthly sound I've ever heard in my life. Tenno Hika Banzai! May the Emperor live 1,000 years! It was terrifying. By the end, the Cameron Highlanders had lost 105 of the 400 men who had silently climbed that hill. 1/4 of the battalion was dead, wounded, or simply missing. David told me that Tam must have been wounded that night, for it was some time before he saw him again. The next time I saw him was in the aid post, David said. The rain had started. We'd lost a lot of men. We'd bitten off more than we could chew for a wee while. And everyone was a bit realistic about things. He paused, and I knew that euphemism was really a description of the deep gloom that must have descended on the battalion. And he had been affected. Tam had been affected. By the look in his eyes, I knew he was trying to shield me from the true horror of just how much my grandfather had been affected. Do you think he was having some sort of combat stress? I just sensed that he had... Before I could continue, something in David's face changed, and he lurched forward in his chair for a second, then caught himself and leaned back. "I just checked myself from contradicting you," he began, and I could swear there was a tear in his eye. He took a moment and swallowed. "Nobody had heard of combat stress in those days, 65 years ago now." "Yes, a long time," I interrupted nervously. "It was a different generation. We were different men. This was a different country." He looked at me sadly, through his steel-rimmed glasses, no longer the soldier filled with pride recalling his acts of bravery. "I never thought that I had any combat stress. But when I was first married, my wife woke me up and said, 'What are you shouting for Sergeant Barrett for?' And he was my old platoon sergeant, the first name I always shouted." He bit his lip and rested his head to one side for a moment. "And my little daughter came up behind me when I was kneeling down doing something in the house, and she said, 'Boof!' And she said I turned around and she knew I could have killed her." I sat in silence. There was no way this man could know the extent of what he had done for me that day. To say that I was thankful, in awe even, didn't do it justice. David looked me deep in the eyes. "He was a good man. He was one of the men that I respected. I did respect your grandfather." "Thank you," I said, fighting back my tears. Then. At the top of our house at Panmure, there was a room called the Big Room. It was where Tom and I did our homework and played games. In the centre of the room, there was a table where we played ping pong. Once Tom had gone off to live with his wife, it became my hiding place. I would contemplate my future, gazing out at the endless rolling fields of the estate that sloped down to the North Sea. It was also where our deep freeze was, so my mum would make sporadic visits upstairs to get some food item or to deposit a Tupperware container of leftovers. But mostly, that room was my domain. The Big Room was symbolic of so many things for me. It meant great solace on the nights when I'd go there to hide and avoid my father's rage, listening to Kate Bush albums and plotting my eventual escape. I remember so vividly when the prospectus of the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama arrived, and I took the first glimpses at the place that was to become my sanctuary. I studied hard at my schoolwork in that room too, rallying myself to be more focused and intent, with the notion that every minute of study represented an hour or a day of freedom in my not-too-distant future. One night, my father pierced through the walls of my asylum. It was the night before my music O-level exam. I was doing well in the subject, but like any hard-working, anxious student, I was spending the night before a big final test cramming and going over the previous year's notes to make sure I was completely prepared. At about 7:30 p.m., my father threw open the door to the Big Room and stood behind me. My desk was in the window that overlooked the nursery and our field, which was presently bereft of sheep, and so had been mowed. "The field's been mowed," my father said in that dark, inevitable way, and I knew this was not going to end well. I turned round to look at him. Surely he wasn't going to... Not tonight, of all nights. "I have my O-level music tomorrow," I said, pleadingly.
"Never mind that," he said,
already turning for the door and his bedroom, where he would change and then leave for the evening, to drink in the local pub or entertain one of his women.
"Get down to that field and rake up that grass."
And he was gone.
"I have to study,"
I shouted after him. These days, my burgeoning teenage manhood made me put up a bit of a, if not a fight, then at least protest.
"Get it done," he thundered.
And I knew I had no choice.
I would have to forgo my last minute studying and spend the evening raking an entire field's worth of grass. It was as if my father had been reading my mind and knew that I'd come to view school as my first step towards freedom. It couldn't have been more of a conscious action on my father's part. He wanted me to fail. I did the raking, eventually having to do so by flashlight as the sun went down. I knew the consequences of that field not being cleared by the time I left for school the next morning were inconceivable. I ran for the bus with blistered hands as my father silently inspected me across the sawmill yard. I felt like I might never get away. That night I got home and he asked me how my exam had gone. I knew I'd done well, but I didn't want to give him that knowledge. I didn't want to let him ever think he was justified. I never did. Instead, I became that much more driven to succeed. Hanging in one of the cupboards of the big room was the uniform my father had kept from his days in the Air Force, a blue, thick, wool, itchy pair of baggy trousers and a short jacket. There was also a long grey raincoat which he said he had worn when he returned to Civvy Street, or the real world, as referred to by the young men in the UK forces. When I left home to go to college, I took these items of my father's, along with a blue sweater vest my mum had knitted for him. I didn't ask if I could have them, for I knew what the answer would be. So I stole them. I'm still not sure why I did this. It was the early 80s, and everyone was wearing baggy vintage ensembles, but that wasn't the whole reason. In some way, I suppose the clothes came to represent my relationship with my dad. I needed a piece of him, something more than bad memories and pain. I needed him to know that I could take too, even if it was only things and not innocence or childhood. And also, they meant it wasn't over. It wouldn't be resolved for many years to come. Over the years, I lost or gave away the army ensemble and eventually the grey raincoat, but never the knitted blue sweater vest. It's upstairs in a closet of my house. I haven't worn it for decades, but I see it every now and then as I reach for things on the high shelf it sits on. Occasionally, I take it down and smell it, imagining I can still feel him, or in some way, Panmure and that time of my life. I realised recently that I wore it in the first headshots I had taken when I was starting out as an actor. I think I needed to remind myself that whatever my future might take me, it was important never to forget where I'd come from. That sweater is still a portal to another time, another life, yet it is a part of my happiness today, because it's a part of me. Saturday the 29th of May, 2010. I woke up the next morning with a hangover. I'd gone out with the crew in Bristol the night before and lots of beer and hardly any water was partaken of. Everyone, it seemed, was up for a big night. I was sharing one of the most revelatory and mind-blowing weeks of my life with relative strangers, but even so, these men and women were almost as emotionally invested in my granddad's story as I was. It made for a good amount of camaraderie and certainly gave me a chance to forget about everything else going on in my life at that moment. We drove back to London on Saturday morning, and I thought about all I'd learned about Tommy Darling. I decided my grandfather was still Tommy to me. He may have been Tam to David and to the men who looked up to him in his battalion, but I knew his secrets, and he would remain forever Tommy. Tommy was a great, respected and decorated soldier, but also a daredevil, cheeky chap, and in search of something. Was it family? Was it thrills? Maybe it was both. It was certainly belonging, and I understood that. I also understood how events or circumstances could cascade out of control, and your entire ability to deal with the present can be lost. When we reached London, we headed for a street just off Piccadilly where, in a very stuffy military officers' club, I was to see yet another historian. Rob Lyman was going to tell me about Tommy Darling's life after the war. I learned from Rob that after his stint in the hospital at Deolali, Tommy Darling returned to duty in India for the remaining months of the war. In 1945, he returned to Britain to visit his wife and family, but that was the last time they would ever see him. He was made an officer and stayed in the army for 4 more years, working in an administrative role in Germany and the UK, close to his family and yet never visiting home. Early in the week, I'd seen on one of the many documents that had been presented to me a contact address for Tommy Darling during a period of leave he had made from the army in St. Albans. This was puzzling. My granny and my mum and uncles were hundreds of miles away at the top of Scotland. Why had my grandfather lived in St. Albans? Why did he never go home? I also knew that my granddad had ended his life in Malaysia, formerly Malaya, working for the Malayan police force, but why he had taken a job so far away from home was also a mystery. Rob, a dashing, natty, signet ring-wearing military type, was dying to explain why. My grandfather had seen a flyer advertising jobs as lieutenants in the Malaysian police force. He was attracted to the chance to see more of the world, to reclaim some of the excitement of war. He was still a young man, with years ahead of him. "It just so happens," Rob said, "that we have managed to find a copy of his application form." He handed it to me and I began to read aloud. "Surname, Darling. Christian name, Thomas. Whether single, married or a widower, I looked along to the end of the line and was completely shocked. Tommy Darling's answer to his marital status was married, and in parentheses, separated. What did that mean? "Separated," I repeated. "Why does my mum not know that?" Immediately I thought of my having to call Mary Darling, who had been so eager for any titbit I'd sent her over the last week. Now I would be the one to tell her that her parents were, in fact, separated when her father went to Malaysia. Rob said nothing. The room was silent except for my breathing. I took a deep breath and sighed it out. "Well, that makes sense," I eventually said. This was why Tommy Darling had never returned to Scotland. This was why he had gone halfway around the world, disappearing forever. Rob went on to tell me that the issue of soldiers being separated from their wives and families back home was a big concern during the war. There was a lot of talk about how this affected the morale of the men at the front. The next line of the form revealed another clue to the mystery. When asked for the numbers of his children, Tommy had written 3, 2 sons and 1 daughter. But he had 3 sons. My uncle Raymond was the youngest child and was not mentioned on this form. Maybe he was born after this. But no, I knew he'd been born in 1942, and Tommy Darling had filled in this application form I was now reading 7 years later, in 1949. They were separated, and Raymond was not listed as being the son of Tommy Darling. It all came into focus. I looked up at Elizabeth, the director, who was looking back at me apologetically. Immediately, I knew. "So Raymond was not his son?" I asked incredulously. "My gran had a child out of wedlock." The parallels of our two stories were running unnervingly closer and closer. "There was no name listed under father on Raymond's birth certificate," Elizabeth said softly. I have now discovered something that my granny did, unbeknownst to her daughter. This is the very same daughter who, according to my father at least, had done exactly the same thing. Honestly, I was too shocked to form words. I let Rob do all the talking. He told me that Tommy Darling continued sending money back home but never once visited. By the time he filled in this application form for the job in Malaysia, the one I was holding, he hadn't seen his children for almost 4 years. I joked with Rob that every time he opened his mouth, I was afraid there would be some new family revelation. I wasn't sure I could handle another one. There was no way of knowing exactly when my grandparents had split up, or even if my granny's pregnancy with my Uncle Raymond was the cause of it. Perhaps they had parted amicably beforehand. There certainly doesn't seem to have been any record of animosity between them, in either the letters and papers that the researchers unearthed, or in the legacy of how he was perceived in my family. But whatever the circumstances, they can only have added to Tommy Darling's isolation and his feelings of loss and dispossession. After he left the army, he made a new life for himself in St. Albans, working in an auto and motorcycle parts shop. But less than a year later, he gave it all up and entered a war zone once more. Clearly, he was drawn to the drama of battle. Civilian life didn't suit him, certainly not once his marriage had ended and his wife had moved on. So Tommy Darling was a lifelong soldier. Maybe the horrors he had encountered in his career were so ingrained in him that he could no longer function unless he had access to their potential. But whatever the reasoning, he was about to walk into the middle of the most brutal of colonial wars. Malaya, or Malaysia as it's now known, was bordered to the north by Thailand, and in turn is just a bridge's distance north of the island of Singapore. It had been part of the British Empire since the early 19th century, and its huge rubber and tin resources made it a hugely valuable asset to the UK. But after the Second World War, Malaya saw growing unrest as its economy suffered, and soon the Malayan National Liberation Army, the military arm of the Malayan Communist Party, began a campaign to disrupt British trade in an attempt to overthrow its colonial rule. In 1948, three European plantation managers were murdered, and what became known as the Malayan Emergency began. Actually, the Malayans called it the Anti-British National Liberation War, but the rubber and tin companies used the term emergency because they would not have been able to claim for any losses from Lloyd's of London had the term war been used. Cheeky, right? In order to fight back at the guerrillas and allow the rubber plantations to continue production, the British government set up villages to house their workers, protected by barbed wire fences and accessible only through checkpoints. But not only were the workers protected, these villages also ensured that the communist insurgents were cut off from them and from any food or supplies they might try to pass on. Nearly 500,000 people were forced to move into these villages, and though many were happy to be protected from the guerrillas, there were also many who were secretly communist sympathisers. So, as if the threat of execution from irate young communist vigilantes was not enough, Tommy Darling would also have to constantly look over his shoulder in case of attack from the very people he was paid to protect, the Malayan workers. Tommy was in an incredibly difficult, dangerous situation. He had to win the confidence of the locals so that they wouldn't betray him to the Maoists. He also had to protect these very same people from constant threat of insurgent attack. Many British officers who went to Malaya were killed. So, was this how Tommy Darling met his fate? Was the shooting accident my mother spoke of a military euphemism for some bleak, bloody political sacrifice? What was even more galling to think was that a mere 7 months after taking up his post in Malaya, Tommy Darling would be dead, at only 35 years of age. This was the point of the story where I'd been warned that Rob could say no more. The next week of filming, commencing in a month's time, would take me to Malaysia, where I would find out the truth about my granddad's death. I said my goodbyes to the crew and decided to walk home through Soho to my flat in an attempt to clear my head. I'd invited a few friends to come over for a little party that night, and I just needed some time alone to let everything sink in before I donned the facade of normality that I needed to wear for the evening. What I couldn't stop thinking about was the similarities between the story that was unfolding on TV and the real one I was experiencing off camera. Both my mother and my grandmother had a child out of wedlock. I could understand how dented Tommy Darling must have been at receiving that news, because I had received such news just days before myself, though Tommy and I had very different perspectives. I was the child of such a union. Tommy was the scorned husband. On a more visceral level, I realised we had both suffered from a form of post-traumatic stress disorder. We had both gone under, slipped through the net for a while. And we both perhaps enjoyed the thrill of danger and excitement because we had, at one time, cheated death, or quivered at the very edge between it and life. I got home and broke down in tears. I was totally exhausted. This week had been the most insane of my entire life. Now, for the first time since this all started, I was able to let go and breathe a sigh of relief because I knew I wouldn't have to gird my loins for any more revelations, at least for a day or two. The DNA test results would arrive back in London the following week, but by then I would be in Cape Town filming that miniseries. Tomorrow I would call my mum and tell her about her parents' separation and Raymond's birth certificate, but for tonight at least, I was a free man. And tonight, as though the showbiz gods could tell that I needed levity and sparkle and wacky Euro froth, was the night of the Eurovision Song Contest. Most Americans, of course, have never heard of this great institution, and I can only feel sorry for them. I know this because I spent almost all of my downtime between takes in the movie Spy Kids playing Eurovision trivia with Antonio Banderas, much to the bemusement of the crew in Austin, Texas. They looked at us as though we were members of a cult, and in a way, we are. It's somewhat daunting to try to convey the enormity of this programme and the far-reaching and intense magic spell it weaves across the European diaspora, but I will try. First of all, anyone who has ever seen it will never be the same again. In terms of its place in the cultural zeitgeist, it is the Oscars and the Super Bowl combined. It is untouchable and awful at the same time. It is a part of every European's pop DNA. It is a rite of passage, a touchstone, and eventually it transcends its awful, shallow shininess to become a communal nostalgic shrine to which we make our annual drunken pilgrimages. It's like Christmas or Thanksgiving, but without the family feuds and with a pretty racy BPM. We grew up with it, and we will almost certainly die with it, or perhaps from it. It gave us ABBA, people. Celine Dion won in 1988, representing Switzerland. Simply put, each year all the countries of Europe come together and each offers up a tacky pop song, sometimes in broken English, sometimes in the indigenous language, previously chosen by the respective publics via the Song for Europe competitions. Think American Idol, X Factor, et al., and you have only half grasped the joy and the horror. Then, one night in May, the final takes place in the previous year's winning country, and basically all of Europe comes to a standstill. I say Europe, but for some reason I've never been able to fathom, and it's Eurovision, so logic is not part of the equation. Israel enters and has actually won several times. I've often thought that if Americans were more exposed to this wonder, there would not only be a huge surge in their understanding of British wit and irony, but they would perhaps be able to appreciate without shame the value of a good old-fashioned tacky pop song. I feel my American friends are so very worried about seeming gauche or vulgar when it comes to pop music. It's only when certain styles of music are placed within the ironic context of retro that Americans can fully enjoy them. We Europeans have never had that problem. Sometimes the lowest common denominator is a positive thing, and people can bond over their love of pop trash. As we prepared for the party, and the stress of my genealogical maelstrom slowly trickled away, I began to worry that perhaps the Eurovision Song Contest had changed. I'd often tried to describe to Grant just how monumental a cultural institution it was, but we'd never been in the UK together when it was on, so I'd never fully succeeded. YouTube clips are all very well, but they don't allow for the sense of occasion, the sense of international rivalry, the tension of the jury's pronouncements, and the sheer joy of hearing bad pronunciation of English over a Europoppy beat. Perhaps I was over-romanticising its surreal qualities. Perhaps Europe had become more sophisticated in its musical tastes and tonight's great expectations would fall a little flat. I needn't have worried. It was a vintage year. For example, Armenia's entry was a haunting power ballad entitled Apricot Stone, about apricot stones. During Spain's rendition of Algo Pequeñito, something tiny, there was a stage invasion, and a man in a funny hat ran on and joined in with the dancers who were dressed as clowns and dolls. Had it not been for the bouncers racing on stage to remove him, I doubt the rest of Europe would have realised this was not rehearsed. But because of this insult to their finely honed performance, something unprecedented happened, and Spain was allowed to perform again at the end of the contest. Perhaps they shouldn't have, though, as sadly this double exposure did little to help their fortunes and they ended up in 15th place. My personal favourite was the Belarus entry, Butterflies, which, two-thirds of the way through, perfectly blended the oral and visual when butterfly wings sprouted from the backs of the three female band members' gowns just as the song edged up a dutiful semitone and one of the boys started a Mariah Carey-style cadenza. Who knew that it would take the Eurovision Song Contest to make me level, to balance the week I had endured, to allow me to revivify my spirit and feel I could take on whatever demons were soon destined to cross my path. Monday the 31st of May 2010. I landed in Cape Town early after flying through the night from London. It was such a relief to be back at work, to have something else to think about. The previous afternoon I'd called my mum and told her the news about her parents having separated and her brother Raymond not being Tommy Darling's son. She admitted that she was not entirely shocked by the news, which gave me some comfort, I suppose. Over the years, she had entertained many possibilities of why her father hadn't been around, and rumours had long circulated within the family about her brother. "It's just good to know the truth, though, isn't it, Alan?" she said. "To have everything cleared up." "Yes, I really think it is, Mum," I replied. There was another truth that I knew would be good for me to hear. The results of the DNA test were due in a few days. The weight was killing me. Going back to work and having a complete change of scene was probably the best thing for me. After I spoke to Mum and said my goodbyes to Grant, who was returning to New York, I left for Heathrow and my next few weeks in South Africa. I love long flights. The feeling of being completely unreachable is something I savour. And the limbo-like state of being, having departed but not arrived, somehow allows me to catch up with myself, to regroup and check in. It's a little contrary to think that I look forward to careering through the skies in a metal-fatigued box in order to gain some feeling of inner calm, but that's the way I roll. But there are other ways my emotions are thrown into flux at 39,000 feet. Films I would never otherwise have watched suddenly seem very alluring and then render me a weeping wreck. Around that time, I remember they all tended to have Sandra Bullock in them. I cry a lot on planes. This flight was no exception. I was returning to South Africa because I was in the middle of shooting a miniseries for British television called The Runaway, based on the novel by Martina Cole. It was set in London's seedy Soho streets in the 60s and 70s, and I played Desiree, a transvestite who runs the Peppermint nightclub and who takes in the eponymous runaway and becomes her matriarchal figure. Desiree was a survivor, literally, for there were more than a few gangland shootouts peppered throughout the six episodes, including one that ended with my Italian gangster boyfriend being gunned down and dying in my arms. And she was also a really kind, dignified person. In sharp contrast to the way most trans people are depicted on screen, Desiree was a very positive role model. That was what made me want to do the series, as well as the fact that I'd just joined the cast of The Good Wife and had spent the previous few months in a suit playing an uptight politico named Eli Gold. Desiree seemed a nice contrast. I traded the suit for stilettos happily. Eli was, and continues to be, quite a revelatory influence in my life, though. He's the first character I've played over a period of years, for starters. Initially, I'd been reticent about going into a long-running show. I'd always done films or theatre, and the little TV I'd done was either for a guest spot or for a short season, so I always knew what the end of the story was. And now, here I was in a situation where my character could suddenly be given a new job, family member, or interest with the advent of the next script. It freaked me out a little at first, but now I've come to enjoy the unknown, partly because I've become more comfortable with the concept, and mostly because the writing on the show is so good, so I relish any new developments in Eli's world. It's also exciting when you make a suggestion about your character and very shortly you find yourself acting it out. In the third season, I told the show's creators, Robert and Michelle King, that I found it very difficult to imagine being someone who never had sex. There were even mentions in the script by Eli about his lack of action in the bedroom. Lo and behold, mere weeks later, I was doing a post-coital scene with the hilarious Amy Sedaris. When I was offered The Runaway, I'd only done a few episodes as Eli, but already he was affecting some big changes in me. First of all, regarding my hair. As detailed in the first chapter of this book, I have had some issues to overcome in the follicle department, and successfully reclaiming control of my tresses has been achieved via a constantly revolving and eclectic range of haircuts throughout my adulthood. All that was about to stop. Since 2010, I've basically had the same do. I can't actually believe it. It gets a little more edgy in the summer hiatus, the sides a little more clipped perhaps, but nothing really radical since I will be back in that suit by summer's end. Also, and much more significant, it is now grey. When I started on the show, it was only for one episode and I was shooting during a break from the movie Burlesque. My hair had been dyed black for Burlesque, and indeed it was coloured regularly for various different projects and often touched up by my hairstylist to keep those pesky grey roots at bay. On the first day of shooting on The Good Wife, I spent a long time in the makeup chair having strands of my locks laboriously streaked with grey to give me a more distinguished and, yes, older countenance. After a few episodes, and when I knew I was going to return as a series regular, I told the hairstylist that we could really cut out the middleman. I would just let the colour grow out and embrace my natural salt and pepper state. And so I did. Going grey is very interesting because it changes people's attitudes towards you much more than if you'd gone blonde or ginger. In some ways it means you're embracing middle age or accepting your mortality and owning it. Suddenly I was being called Daddy and included in fawning magazine articles with other noted salt and pepper locked men. In some way it was assumed I was doing it as a political gesture, embracing my middle age as well as my inner child and trouncing the notion that grey couldn't be sexy. Actually, I was not meaning to do any of those things. I just didn't want to have to get up half an hour earlier every day and be poked with grey mascara brushes. It's also interesting to note that each summer during the hiatus of The Good Wife, I've rushed from the relative calm of our studios in Brooklyn to start work on projects that could not be more different in tone or content from Eli's trajectory as a political wheeler and dealer in contemporary Chicago. Year one, to South Africa to be Desiree. Year two, to LA to shoot Any Day Now, in which I play a 1970s drag queen who, with his attorney boyfriend, attempts to adopt a child with Down syndrome. Year three, to Scotland, to play a man who is admitted to a psychiatric unit and then proceeds to act out the entire play of Macbeth. Year four, mercifully still in New York City, but remounting the crazy that is Macbeth on Broadway. I guess I'm not quite at peace with playing middle-aged guys in suits. As soon as I landed, I was plunged back into my life in Cape Town. I was picked up at the airport by my driver, Hodges, a huge African man whose laugh was so bassy and reverberating that the entire car shook when I said something that set him off. It reminded me of my old habit of standing up against the speaker in a club to feel the beat. When Hodges laughed, I really felt it. I went straight to the set for a makeup test, then a wardrobe fitting, then back home to the downtown apartment building where most of the cast were barracked, where a lovely manicurist, or nail technician as she preferred to be called, was waiting to reattach the acrylic nails that Desiree sported and I had relinquished before I left for Cannes. Another thing I relinquished was my body hair. Desiree would not have entertained a hairy arm, and therefore neither did I. Before the first day of filming this series, I had spent an evening in the company of a product called Veet, which, though well known to the female species by other names such as Nair, had hardly ever entered my mental periphery. It is now, however, forever seared into my brain. Do you know what Veet or Nair does? It dissolves the hair off your body. Surely this was an invention of the Nazis. You rub it on, sometimes to very sensitive parts of your anatomy, and very soon the hair just dissolves. It is not a pretty procedure, and it sure as hell doesn't smell pretty either. But because of Desiree, Veet became a part of my toilette, and I would have to have another application this evening as the stubble on my arms was becoming noticeable. When my Who Do You Think You Are episode was eventually broadcast, I was really shocked to see my plucked chicken appearance due to the lack of body hair. It's not a good look for me, believe me. Playing Desiree made me think of women in a completely different way, and certainly to have a whole new level of respect for them. Aside from the obvious things like the pain of wearing those shoes, I encountered a whole range of new experiences, most of them utterly unpleasant. Bras are not comfortable, for one thing. They're itchy and restricting and have weird wires and springs, making you feel as if you're wearing some sort of cantilever system rather than an article of clothing, which of course you are. Also, as wearing silicone breasts, or chicken cutlets as they're also known and closely resemble, silicone crammed against your skin by a bra was a double discomfort whammy, and it was a whole new experience for me to get undressed and find I had a sweaty chest. and dresses and skirts generally don't allow you to open your legs very far. Guys, have you tried getting out of a car without opening your legs recently? You have to sort of scoosh along the seat, one buttock at a time, then try and push yourself up on your spindly high heels and hope that you're on a smooth surface when you make contact with the ground. And nails are another issue. When they're long, they clank and catch on things, and even the nail polish made me feel like my nails couldn't breathe. You should have seen the anemic, soft mess that was left underneath when my acrylic nails were eventually removed by soaking my fingers in some form of carcinogenic chemical mixture, of course. Yes, wearing high heels makes your legs look better and your ass look amazing, but I still couldn't help but worry that they were making me more vulnerable at the same time. My ass and my boobs were not just more prominently displayed. It was almost as though the only way I could balance at all was to thrust them out to the world. And what if I wanted to run? Forget about it. If I could have maneuvered even a light trot in my heels before plunging to the deck, the pain of trying to run in such unnatural and uncomfortable footwear would have laid me up for weeks. For yes, being a woman, even one with a penis, and for the purposes of drama, really made me feel that women have been coerced into a way of presenting themselves that is basically a form of bondage. Their shoes, their skirts, even their nails seem designed to stop them from being able to escape, whilst at the same time drawing attention to their sexual and secondary sexual characteristics. And I think this has happened so that men feel they can ogle them and protect them in equal measure. Just saying. I was feeling especially vulnerable for a multitude of reasons, you see. That night I went to bed duly plucked. Tomorrow I would be up at the crack of dawn and back to work. Tommy Darling's odyssey to Malaysia and the mystery of the final months of his life would remain a mystery for the next month. And the question of whether or not Alec Cumming was my birth father would not be answered for a few days either. I carefully pulled up the blankets with my reattached talons and fell into a deep and grateful sleep. Then, I woke up happy in my brother's spare room and then suddenly remembered what I had to do that day. The scariest thing I would ever do in my life. I could hear Tom making breakfast downstairs. The night before we had talked it all through and I'd written it all down in case I got so nervous that I couldn't remember anything. I was really worried I wasn't going to be able to get through it. As soon as I'd started to have the flashbacks, I knew in my heart that the only way I was going to be able to get better, to truly exercise the pain and move on, was to one day talk to my father about it all. They'd started in my dreams. Dark dispatches dropped into my sleep that I began to realise were nightmares that had actually happened. Soon after, I didn't need to be asleep. My stomach would knot up and I could see my father's face coiled in rage as though it was yesterday. I could hear the dull ringing in my ears that was left after he made contact with my head. The sting, the dizziness, the inability to breathe, the humiliation, the shame, the despair that had been recorded in my mind so many years before now played back for the first time. I'd cut myself off from my life. I was now in a cocoon with no responsibilities of work or marriage. I left the little flat mostly to eat or to go to therapy. The rest of the time I was free to just feel, to remember and mourn. I realised I had never just stopped like this in my entire life. Finally now I was ready to go where I needed to go. What started as a trickle soon turned into a flood. I spent days just gazing at the ceiling of my little flat, remembering and reliving pieces of my childhood that I could now fully access. It was truly horrifying. But it was also incredibly liberating because in accessing these horrible memories, I was beginning to understand who I really was. Such a huge part of my psyche had been closed off for so long, and now I was embracing the fullness of my life experience for the first time. It's hard to express how fragile I felt in those early days. To begin with, I was terrified to tell anyone what I was experiencing, partly because the memories were so raw and painful that it was difficult to talk about it at all without collapsing, and partly because I had a great fear of not being believed. And then I felt anxious about the prospect of talking about all of this with Tom and Mum. What if they weren't ready, and I was forcing them to confront a morass of pain and shame that they never wanted to revisit? Worse, what if they couldn't deal with it at all? What if they didn't believe me? I needn't have worried. I talked to Mum first, My domestic situation had obviously changed and she was naturally worried about why. We spoke on the phone one night and I told her what had been happening, how I had begun to remember so many awful things that Dad had done and was now beginning to understand the vastness of how much I had been damaged by him. She couldn't have been more loving and understanding. She told me she'd always worried that this part of my past was going to come back and haunt me. We spoke as two survivors, now finally able to acknowledge our shared past. A couple of days later I saw Tom, and over a long dinner we talked quite calmly and precisely about many, many instances of our father's madness and violence. It was good to do so in such a rational, unemotional way. It made it all real and valid. We walked through the streets of London deep in conversation, both of us feeding each other forgotten nuggets of memory. We expressed to each other for the first time how we felt in many, many instances of shame and violence we had endured. When we arrived at where Tom was staying, we hugged goodnight and suddenly we both began weeping uncontrollably, our chests heaving with grief for the two little scared boys we had been for so long. All that summer, sorting myself out in Primrose Hill, I had been working up to this day. I'd been seeing a therapist for many months, and early on he had told me that a confrontation would be a necessary part of my recovery. Even Mary Darling had said I should. Tom and I both agreed that we needed to do it, but it was easier said than done. We were effectively going back to the place where it had all happened to confront our abuser about incidents and memories that had just recently appeared back in our psyches and were still incredibly raw and painful. But we were now ready, I hoped. I picked up the papers from the bedside table and read over what I'd written. It seemed so weird to see the entire thing encapsulated so neatly. Only 2 pages of A4, but packed with portent. Dad, the way you behaved towards us throughout our childhood has had a huge effect on us and has caused us many problems. You brutalized and terrorized us. We were made to feel useless, unworthy. We lived in constant fear of you. Not just of being hit, but also of being constantly shouted at and brought down and tormented. We were never good enough for you. We could never live up to your expectations. We were made to feel we were not capable of doing anything. You would ask us to do tasks for you that we couldn't possibly achieve, and then you would chastise us and hit us for not doing them well enough. So consequently, we've gone through life feeling unhappy and unable to acknowledge our achievements because we still feel unworthy, as being told we are useless is so ingrained in us. We have made excuses for your behaviour all our lives. We were embarrassed because people laughed and didn't believe us if we told them about the violence, about you stopping us from going to things at the last minute, the way you made us work all the time, and so we started to make up excuses for you, so much so that we all pretended that nothing was really wrong and none of this ever happened until it exploded out earlier this summer. But we also felt it was our fault. We were led to believe that the reason you hit us, the reason you went out nearly every night, the reason you had very obvious affairs, the reason Mum was unhappy was all our fault. Because you told us we were useless, and we believed you, and took all the blame for ourselves. But we are not useless. As children, when we most needed support and encouragement and love, when we were at our most vulnerable and impressionable, we had as a role model a man who hit us and never encouraged us or said a positive thing to us. We felt unloved. You didn't really like us. Maybe you still don't. You had a problem with violence. We would have been taken into the care of the authorities if they had found out about the extent and regularity of your violence. Hitting an 8-year-old boy so hard that he's thrown across a room is not right. You'd have been arrested on many occasions. You had no control of your temper. You totally flipped. You had psychopathic tendencies. We lived in constant fear. We were terrified of our own father, the man who should have been protecting us. You never encouraged us to pursue our own interests, so we consequently had to keep them secret. You would stop us from leaving the house to go out. We felt no security in our own decisions and skills. We want to say all this to you to make you understand how we feel and how we've been affected by the past, and that not having spoken about it is so wrong and damaging for everyone. We want you to somehow acknowledge that you remember some of the things we're talking about. In some way, talking about it is acknowledging that it happened, and we are releasing the past. letting it go so we can all move forward and on. We are giving you back the things you gave us. I put the papers down. So many thoughts were whirring through my head. Tom and I had both been through a summer of intense examination and analysis of the events of the past, but I was nervous that suddenly springing all this on our father would alienate him and do the exact opposite of what we both intended and needed, which was some sort of acknowledgement of his actions and ownership of the past. I didn't want to scare him away, but I wanted him to hear the truth too. But also, I had no choice in the matter. I had to do this. I knew it. Tom knew it. Our whole lives had been leading up to this moment. We were going to give back to our father that which was not ours, and what we never should have been given in the first place. Tom had called him earlier in the week to ask if we could come and see him as we needed to talk about some things, so my father must have grasped that this was not merely a pleasant family trip. The very fact that we were visiting at all was a rarity by this point. I hadn't seen him for several years. Since I'd moved to London in 1988, the visits out of duty had grown more and more sporadic. When I was married, and my wife and I regularly came to stay with my in-laws who lived a few miles away, I often didn't even let my father know I was coming. And he certainly never visited me. In fact, I realised in the run-up to this monumental meeting that my father had never once called me on the telephone in my entire adult life. He had spoken to me, sure, after the phone was passed to him by my mother, and once my parents separated, I had called him, but he had never once picked up the phone himself and dialed my number. I had flown up to Scotland from London the night before and spent the evening talking and remembering with Tom. We both knew how right this was, how necessary, but it still scared the shit out of us. We'd had a good few drinks to lighten our spirits and gird our loins, and now, here we were, the next day, in his car on our way to Panmure, about to confront our father with our childhood demons. As we passed through the gates and the big looming sign that read, "Private Estate, Trespassers Will Be Prosecuted," my heart began to pound. Everything seemed to be floating by in slow motion. The head gamekeeper's house, the cottages where the wife of one of my father's workers had taught me piano, the little box at the corner that I'd rushed to every Saturday morning to collect my comic book. By the time we turned right and could see the sawmill yard, my hands had begun to shake. "I'm not sure I can do this, Tom," I said, my breath suddenly shallow, my mouth so dry I could barely swallow. And I was totally serious. I felt completely out of my depth, like the little boy I once was walking down this road into a world that made no sense and that was so out of my control. "You're going to be fine. I'm here with you. We're doing this together," said Tom. We pulled up in front of the house and sat for a moment in the car, just staring at the grey stone edifice before us. Sometimes, when you come back to places from your childhood, they seem smaller, less daunting. But this place seemed as bleak and gothic and unwelcoming as it had when we were little boys. "You okay?" Tom asked. "I think so," I whispered. "Just try and stay calm and not let him get to you." "I'm really scared," I said. "Remember, he doesn't control us anymore, Alan." I loved my brother so much in that moment. We got out of the car and rang the doorbell, but then moved back up the drive a bit as though to protect ourselves from a looming explosion. After a moment, our father appeared through the mottled glass of the porch, like a memory coming back into focus. We watched him, hanging back, gauging him. Then he opened the door. "Aye," he said. "Are you coming in?" Tom and I had both decided that we couldn't enter the house. It would be too unnerving to discuss past incidents that may have occurred in the very room we were sitting in. And also, we didn't want to do this in his territory, be trapped on his home turf. "We'd actually like to go for a walk, if that's okay with you," said Tom. "All right," he murmured, and disappeared into the house, returning moments later in a jacket, with a large, rough-hewn wooden stick in his hand. His little West Highland Terrier scampered up to us, breaking the tension that was beginning to crackle all around. "You wanted to talk about something," he began, hitting his stick against the side of his work boot as we began to walk up the yard. "Yes, we are." I was amazed to hear my voice, quite calm, quite strong. "We want to talk to you about stuff that happened when we were little." He said nothing, but cleared his throat noisily and spat into a drain. Undaunted, I continued. I don't know if you know, but I've been having a bit of a bad time recently.
I hear your marriage is broken up, he said suddenly and accusingly.
That's right, I said, trying not to let him needle me. It has. I put my hand in my pocket to feel the bits of paper for reassurance. I've been in a bit of a state for most of this year, actually. And my marriage fell apart under the strain of that. I was beginning to stumble. This wasn't good.
Is it definitely over?
He asked.
What was this, concern?
No, surely not. That was never in his lexicon. Could it possibly be he was using the failure of my marriage as a smokescreen for what he'd somehow intuited was going to be a condemnation of him? Was he trying to shift the focus? That made sense. He was like an animal now, sizing me up, sniffing my fear. Yes. I felt the weight of my words, their portent, their resignation. Yes, it's definitely over. We're getting a divorce, I said, careful to seed no weakness with this statement. I had jumped off the cliff now. This was on. Tom glanced over at me, willing me strength. Part of the reason that happened is that I had a bit of a breakdown earlier in the year and it made it harder and harder for me to be able to function. And I remembered a lot of things that both Tom and I had suppressed for many, many years. Memories of things that happened in our childhood. Things you did that we don't think were right. And we've come today to talk to you about them.
Oh, aye,
he said again, and began walking up the yard away from us, whistling for his dog as he did so. The walk was a very long one. We went all the way down to the other end of the estate, nearly to the garden house where, as a young boy, I'd gone to pick the raspberries that now adorned its once ornate terraces. At this point, my dad turned on Tom, goading him about how often he saw his eldest son from his previous marriage. It was as though our father really was trying to equate his actions with our failed relationships. And perhaps he had a point, though not the one I'm sure he intended. A successful relationship requires a level of self-knowledge and comfort with oneself, and neither Tom nor I had much of that at the moment. We were stumbling towards it, but only just. These past few months had completely changed us both. We had spent so many nights on the phone, relaying to each other a new memory, backing up dim visions with the assurance that the other had the same memory, that what we remembered was real. It is a startling thing, the need to feel utterly believed. Memories that were so tender and tentative could not be entrusted to anyone who might possibly doubt them during those months I was sequestered in Primrose Hill, sorting myself out. Tom and I were only just beginning to believe and fully understand the scope of what we'd been through, so it was so important to us to hear that we were accepted and understood. Luckily, we had waited until our arsenal of memories was so vivid that our father's most intense scare tactics and mind games could not shake us. But believe me, he tried his hardest. Nobody plays nice when he is cornered. For a man like him, it was the most uncomfortable and painful place to be, and he was not equipped for it, aside from falling back on his default behaviours of manipulation and intimidation. My most vivid memory of our conversation is of my father's utter silence. I'd said that I knew he must remember some of what we were speaking of, and his silence, aside from a whistle for the dog and the vicious thump to the inside of his boot with his stick, was proof that he did. "What was your childhood like?" I asked him. "Did Grandad hit you?" I was both fascinated and scared about the prospect of my father not being able to break a circle of abuse, because that might mean I would be unable to, too. He ignored me. "Did you never feel bad about hitting us?" Again, he started off in front of us, desperate to avoid. But we were in the middle of the estate's most huge and sprawling drive. There were no cars coming. There was nobody around. There was nowhere to run. I scampered after him. "Do you think you hit us because you were so unhappy in your marriage?" He turned to me, fury in his eyes. "My marriage was over 4 years after Tommy was born," he spat. I stopped in my tracks, shocked, and watched him as he walked away. "Thanks," I called after him. "That's 2 years before I was even born. That makes me feel great." Tom was beside me, his hand on the small of my back, propelling me down the drive to catch up with him. "Why didn't you leave then?" I demanded when we had caught up with him. "I had kids to think of." he replied with a mixture of indignation and righteousness that was both galling and horribly predictable. Of course, he would be able to justify his presence in our lives, the very presence that allowed his sons to be repeatedly abused, with his fatherly duty to protect them. "I had kids to think of," he actually said, staring at the very kids who were then doing their best to explain to this man that he had never once thought of their welfare, that his care of them had not been care at all. "Where were they?" I said to his retreating back. "Where were these kids you were thinking of? Because they sure as hell weren't Tom and me." His only response was the usual litany of spitting, banging his boot with his stick and whistling for the dog.